I am 19. The 29th of April 1972 to the 28th of April 1973. Above. Me and Linda Lovelace by Ian Williams. Well, here I am, the big 19. Being 18 is meant to be the life-changing age, but that was so last year. I understand that the average age of the combat soldier in the Vietnam War is 19. Glad we haven't got screwed in that pointless contest. I'm free to enjoy my life, and that is what I'm going to do, and I'm going to keep a record of it in my diary and pictures. I've been given a new Instamatic camera where you take the picture and within minutes can see the photo. No more waiting for weeks for your picture to be returned by crappy print or whatever they're called. I'm going to change the world and enjoy myself doing it. I need to change the government and definitely the music scene. At the moment, we're surrounded by sugar-coated shite from the likes of the Osmonds and David Cassidy. I hate it that the girls all want posters of them on their walls and fancy them. I'm going to make them all notice what real music is and what real men are. Slade are a bit more edgy, but then they dress up like clowns, which lets them down. We need change. I want change. I want to overthrow the government too. Get rid of Heath. That Tory leader has no idea what he is doing. He leads a party of morons and the prices are ripping away. My usual pint, or eight, of Courage Tavern has just increased from 15 pence to 17 pence. At this rate, I'll only be able to get pished on weekends rather than be mildly steaming all week. I'm going to make sure that 19 is the year of the party, the year of awesome shags, the year that the world, no, the universe, notices William Ernest Drummond. I might become a mercenary, or perhaps an astronaut, or a world-famous pop star, or simply an international playboy. I jet around the globe to the Caribbean or to Monaco, to Hollywood, and party hard with the likes of Janice Dickinson and Lauren Hutton. I might let Marlon Brando or Ryan O'Neill tag along. Perhaps Linda Lovelace will also want to come. I've got so much I need to do before I'm 70. Wow, that is over half a century away. I don't want to get there with no hair, no teeth, and having not achieved anything. Before I take over the world, perhaps, I should start off slightly smaller by writing my revolutionary thoughts in a book. Not a Mein Kampf or a Das Kapital. They were weird and boring and didn't do the authors any favours. I will make mine more relevant and more pithy to begin with. And then, when the public recognise me, I can then move on to my real manifesto. I will begin with recording my thoughts, such as not liking morning people or mornings or people, or that they're is a fine line between genius and crazy, and you should cross that line regularly. Or that dreams can come true with lots of money, a great body, and a great voice. These may need a little work, but I just know that this is the beginning of something big. This is the last year of my teens. I can't believe that they started 6 years ago when I knew so little of so little. I only knew that my body was changing, but looking back, I was still a child. I am now a man and want to see greater changes. It would be fantastic if I can claim the world before I'm in my 20s. And the history books would recognise that and bow before the mighty bill.
Below, Mucky Mags by Andrew Austin. As a 19-year-old, you're considered an adult, much as you are as an 18-year-old, in fact. But as an 18-year-old, you are afforded the privilege of being a new adult, freshly adult. It has taken me turning 19 to learn of this. At 19, I feel I've been exposed to some of the more mundane aspects of being an adult, and that I'm expected to expect this and accept this. I'm fearing this may be the start of a slippery slope, that it's all downhill from here. Thus, it has occurred to me that 19 is the perfect age for daydreaming. Or that this is the age at which a whole new world of daydreaming begins. One that will only progress and intensify as I advance in years, until I am so old that I am completely lost in my daydreams. It's not necessarily something I'm actively seeking out either, more that it's where my mind goes when it's in the mood for going. And lately, it's going. Or gone. For illustrative purposes, here's an example. A few months ago, while walking past a familiar hedgerow, I spotted something unfamiliar, brightly coloured, glossy, flapping about in the breeze. A magazine? Yes. French, no less. And of the top-shelf variety. I leaned into the undergrowth and pulled it free, stowed it away under my jacket. A week or so later, same place, same again. A pattern begins to emerge. Germany, France, Holland, or Belgium perhaps. Yet until these past couple of weeks, the source of these continental curios had remained elusive. But then, out early one morning, I see a lorry driver pull up and unceremoniously cast another cachet to the wind and nature. Having witnessed this ritual in the flesh, as it were, I feel I can make two assumptions. The first being that said lorry driver must live somewhere around these parts and chooses to offload this particular portion of his cargo before his missus gets wind of his penchant for mucky mags. The second being, given that most of his chosen reading material is from overseas, his job must mostly involve hauling goods coming in from the ports. I've heard that the sailors and dockers like to trade such commodities. A couple of mine for a couple of years. What's familiar for them being fanciful for us, and vice versa. I should like to point out that my interest in these magazines is not purely a prurient one. Partially, yes, but not entirely. This is where the daydreaming fits in. You see, it's more that I like to imagine myself walking a proverbial mile or kilometre in their shoes. They, being the ladies featured in the pictorials, that is. Without their poise, strength and beauty radiating from the pages, such magazines as these would amount to nothing. My thoughts do not occur in any manner particularly exotic or glamorous. Mostly they're passing through sequences of everyday activities. Buying bread from a bakery, walking home from a cinema, watching the world go by from the table of a cafe, waiting for a bus. And if that should seem to anyone else to make for rather mundane daydreaming material, then I would argue that it's only because you don't have the magazines in question at hand for context. They serve to render the more drab parts of my existence into the same glossy, colourful hues I saw flapping in the breeze, amidst a thicket of leaves and branches. Sometimes you've got to take inspiration where you can find. Sometimes you find it stuffed into a hedge. If nothing else, these excursions into fantasy have helped distract me from some of my worries about the world. Take music, for instance. More specifically, one aspect of music. That aspect being the current rock and roll revival. Is that what we've come to? Not even 2 decades hence, and only a couple of years into these 1970s? While I understand that culture has always been something akin to a rissole, miscellaneous bits dusted off, mashed together and served up anew, it occurs to me that here we are, warming over some rock and roll leftovers for our tea, when we still feel fairly full after having only just eaten them at lunchtime, and they've barely even had a chance to cool off yet. Wouldn't it be better if we waited a while before consuming them again and prepared something different for tea instead? I wonder perhaps if this is a generational development and we're to chalk it up to the ageing teddy boys and greasers indoctrinating their children, likely around the same age as I am, depressingly enough, into somehow reliving their own youth and to bow before their idols. Just because the leather jacket now fits, are we forever doomed to wear it? Now, I've got nothing against rock and roll such as it was, nothing at all. You can still play many fine singles of that era and feel the same raw buzz of energy lighten the walls of their grooves, magically released by the passage of the stylus, as if it were some ancient species of wasp, perfectly preserved for an eternity within a tawny blob of prehistoric tree sap. But this isn't archaeology of which we speak. Old bones, yes, but these dinosaurs walk among us still. They didn't really require any unearthing. No ancient relics here, no Roman mosaic or Grecian urn. If we're digging for anything here, it feels more like coal, and not the kind of coal that generates our warmth and light either. More like the coal that those on the naughty list find in their stockings on Christmas morning. For the record, I've nothing against stockings either, or hosiery of any other variety for that matter. These magazines I've been finding have most certainly affirmed that. Elise looks very fetching in her stockings, here on page 29. Although, to be fair, Marielle looks equally terrific without any, on page 54.
A Troubled Dream. Bad Luck Comes in Threes, by S.J. Bradley. It is night time in the A303, and you are sliding around inside the back of a transit van with 3 other men, all of you long-haired and wild-eyed. The van is bumpy. It has no suspension, and it stops in a lay-by, and then somehow, you're at Stonehenge. The stones feel cold beneath your fingers. It's like being in a meat locker out here. You feel the moss on your fingertips, and then you look around for the accomplice and the driver and the other man. But when you take your fingers away from the stone, something sticks to your fingers. It's not moss, but something else gluey. And when you try and rub it off your hands, it spreads further, covering your hands in a dark grey paste, making it look like you have some foul disease, as though you're rotten from the inside out. You look around for your friends, but there's nobody else there. When you turn and look back to the road, the van has gone. The road is empty. You try to call for them, but no sound comes out of your mouth. So, you turn back around to look at the ancient stone circle. To look again at the stones, 20 feet high. And as you're looking at these stones, that's when it happens. That's when the ground folds up and lifts the stones overhead towards you, and they all close down on you to eat you up like teeth in a mouth. Another time, you're in a gallery. The walls and corridors are white, and the paintings and sculptures are all white. You're here to buy yourself something, but when you try to remember which, you can't. There's a man walking around somewhere, youngish, on a mobile phone. His accent is so received pronunciation, it sounds like he's speaking in a foreign language. You try to find him, but every time you walk through a doorway or through an archway or into one of the galleries, he disappears. You are only able to catch a glimpse of him from the corner of your eye. You never get a full look at him. All you can hear is the drone of his voice as he walks from room to room, telling the person on the other end about all the paintings he's going to buy. He sounds bored, and at the same time, as though he's just showing off. As you stand in front of one of the white paintings, you realise there is something in your hands. It's a keytar, exactly like the one you used to have back in art college, the one you thought you'd lost. You reach down to play it, and that's when you see that the black keys and the white keys are all the same colour. White. They move around as you go to touch them. And because they're doing this, and because they're all the same, you can't tell which is which key is middle C and which key is A-flat. When you manage to touch one, a noise comes out like a ship's horn. It echoes through the gallery. You try to move your hand away to make the sound stop, but the keyboard keys won't let you go. They reach out and gnaw you, eating at your fingers and hands and your wrists. And they get larger as they come forth from the keyboard, working their way up your arm as they grow larger and more powerful, eating up sinew and blood and bone, working their way upwards to eat you all up like teeth in a mouth. Another time, you're on a boat in the dark. It's peaceful on the coracle, just you and one other man, and you're both fishermen. You're both wearing sou'westers and yellow oilskin jackets and thick knitted jumpers. He says to you,
"Throw these lobster pots in the water, Bill."
So you grab one of the pots to throw it in, but the lobster pot has already got a lobster in it. The lobster is large, and it looks angry, clicking away there inside the pot with his big red claws. The man says,
"Get a move on, Bill. We need to throw them all in before it gets hungry."
"Before what gets hungry?" you say, even though you already know what he means. You start throwing the lobster pots in as fast as you can, lots of them. But no matter how many lobster pots you throw splashing into the sea, the boat still seems to be full of them. The pile never gets any smaller, as though the pots are regenerating somehow. The lobsters inside nip at your cold, cold fingers, and the waves of the sea grow, making the tiny boat rock around like a leaf being buffeted by the wind. And the waves grow taller, sending the boat flying, so it first goes vertical this way, then that way, like a Viking ship in a fairground. And soon, when you try to throw the lobster pots, you no longer know which way to aim, and they fall back and hit you in the face. Then the waves reach high on one side, and they don't go down again until you see suddenly that what they were hiding was a mouth and a set of teeth. And when you go to throw the next lobster pot in the water, it's already too late. And the wave teeth and the wave mouth clamp down on the boat, and both of you and the little boat all disappear into the blackness like teeth in a mouth.